Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the apparent meltdown that's going on now in Iraq, with the intra-Shia fighting. The government appears to be irrelevant. The men with the guns appear to be in charge of the country, if anybody's in charge. And we'll be talking in a moment with Joshua Holland and Riyad Jarrah. Joshua Holland is a senior writer and editor of Alternet. He heads the online magazine's Iraq special coverage, and he's also the winner of the 2007 Project Censored Award, and he's recipient of the Schuman Foundation's Grant for Independent Journalists. And Riyad Jarrah is an Iraqi-born architect and political analyst who moved to the United States in 2005. He was the director of the only door-to-door casualty survey in Iraq in 2003, and then established a local Iraqi grassroots organization that carried out hundreds of reconstruction projects in 10 Iraqi cities. And he's currently the Iraq consultant for the American Friends Services Committee. So we'll be talking to him. He's in touch with friends and relatives over there to get an understanding of this latest twist in this long war in Iraq. And we'll also then talk about the economy in terms of an analysis of this massive transfer of wealth that's taken place, where poor and middle class, working class blacks and Hispanics managed to get into what George W. Bush referred to as an ownership society, only to see their houses foreclosed on them. A lot of people on Wall Street have gotten very rich out of this catastrophe and the subprime meltdown, and a lot of people who thought they were upwardly mobile are now stranded. And we'll look into phenomenon with Michael Perlman, who's an author of a new book, The Confiscation of American Prosperity, From Right-Wing Extremism and Economic Ideology to the Next Great Depression. And then we'll go to Norway and speak with Nicholas March, who's a research fellow at the International Peace Research Institute in Norway, and he's an expert in the international arms trade. And Nicholas March has been following the story which broke this week in the New York Times about Ephraim Diveroli, who at the age of 21 received a $300 million contract from the Bush administration to supply arms to the Afghan military. He has no background in the arms trade. His partner in the business is a former masseur, and only in George Bush's America, apparently, can you get $300 million of your money. We'll be talking about that. And now speaking with Joshua Holland and Riyad Jarrah, and as I mentioned, Joshua Holland is the senior writer and editor of Alternet. He's the recipient of the 2007 Project Censored Award and a recipient of the Schuman Foundation Grant for Independent Journalism. And Riyad Jarrah is an Iraqi architect, Iraqi-born architect, political analyst. He moved to the United States in 2005, and he was the director of the only door-to-door casualty survey in Iraq in 2003. And Riyad, this intra-Shiite violence between, I guess it's largely between the Sardis people and they're called ISKRI now, I believe, the Abdelaziz Hakim's group. The battle started in Basra, apparently over largely for the government to seize control of the oil revenues from the various militias who have been siphoning it off. Of course, the nominal leader of this government, it's largely, I think, been fairly irrelevant, isn't it? Wouldn't survive 10 minutes outside of the green zone. But al-Maliki apparently said, vowed that we'd crush these people and drive them into submission. And now his palace has been shelled and rocketed in Basra. He had to get out. What's the latest? I know you're talking to people in Iraq. What's the latest in terms of the battle lines, if you will?
I don't think there are many important developments on the ground other than the fight continuing. It doesn't seem that either side want to stop fighting soon. And it seems like the conflict is spreading to other cities other than Basra. Today we saw some clashes around the south and in Baghdad.
And is this basically exposing the irrelevance of this government that the United States has set up? It seems to me that what's happening now, the militias, the men with the guns, are really what's relevant.
It shows what are the real, goals of the current Iraqi executive branch, and it exposes the reality of the governmental forces. No one in Iraq believes that the current governmental armed forces can be called an Iraqi national army. People call them usually the governmental militias, and they call the militias outside the government the non-governmental militias. So it just exposes the real dynamics. There is no real government that is fighting for Iraq's stability. In fact, there are some powers that are supported by the U.S. who are fighting against their political rivals. This is the situation in the Basra now. And the other thing that it exposes is that the Iraqi conflict is not a sectarian or religious one, as the administration and mainstream media has been repeating for years now. This is an excellent example of how two Arab groups, two Shiite groups, two Southern groups are fighting, not because of their sectarian or religious differences or because of their ancient hatred or whatever the Bush administration is telling the U.S. people, but because of their political and economic differences. They have two different agendas for the future of the country, and these two different agendas don't have anything to do with people's sectarian or religious backgrounds.
And Joshua Holland, the president apparently encouraged al-Maliki to make this move, and apparently al-Maliki is now sort of wavering in his, at least he's retreating from his original vow to crush the Mahdi militia. And is this, do you have a sense that this thing could unravel further, and that essentially, I mean, the surge, as far as I can tell, was essentially we made a deal with the devil, did we not, with the Sunni militias? The drop in violence has nothing to do with troop level so much as the fact that the people who were shooting us before have stopped shooting us, and in fact we've turned around and started to arm them. And I'm just wondering whether, as the Shia fight amongst themselves, whether perhaps the Sunni may seize an opportunity, in spite of what Raed has just said, that these aren't really sectarianly driven, they're really driven by political motivations. So can you address that?
Well, look, the instability that we're seeing is spreading, and I think it's important to point out that, you know, it's not so much a factor of the Iraqi government cracking down on militias in the south. It has been very clear that it has been a crackdown on only one group of militias, the Sadrists. And in fact, we've had reports out of Karbala that the Badr Brigade, which is the armed wing of ISKRI, and for which Maliki depends for his coalition, has been fighting openly alongside government forces. So, we're seeing all of the fractures, the political fractures that have been largely underreported in the U.S. press, really coming to a head right now. And I think that the next place that you really have to look for this kind of violence to flare up, let me take a step back. This was precipitated directly by the passage of a law which calls for provincial elections in October. The outcome of those elections are going to go a long way towards determining the future of the Iraqi state, what it looks like, how its oil revenues are exploited, how they are distributed. And this move, I think it seems clear to me anyway, was a way to basically undercut the Sadrist support in those southern provinces that are going to vote before the vote. So when you look at the next fault line that's likely to come up in this same kind of issue, it is likely to be in the north, where you have a very similar kind of dynamic, two different, fundamentally different visions of how the relationship between the central government and provincial government will be, and a lot of people who are heavily armed.
Are you referring, when you talk about the north, you're referring to the Kurds or the north of Baghdad? I mean,
No, I'm specifically speaking about Kirkuk, and
okay.
There's a very long-standing conflict over the future of Kirkuk. There was supposed to have already been a referendum on what will happen with Kirkuk, and it was delayed because I think that there was a widespread acknowledgement that if they pushed that referendum, given the lack of real democratic institutions in the country, given the lack of confidence in this government and legitimacy of the government, it was going to precipitate exactly the kind of thing that we're seeing spreading all throughout the South right now.
But you're not suggesting that the two Shia groups that are now fighting, that the two Kurdish mafia that essentially run the North, which are the Barzanis and the Talibanis, they're not going to fight amongst themselves. This will be a fight.
That would be likely. It would be between the Kurdish regional government and various Sunni groups.
I see. And
there has been extensive ethnic cleansing in the neighborhood level. I mean, when we say that there's the central conflict in Iraq is not sectarian, that's not to deny that there is intense sectarian rivalries and a lot of violence that's happening on the street level.
Mm-hmm.
Muqtada al-Sadr gave a very rare interview last week to Al Jazeera, and he said exactly that. He said, you know, when you're looking in the neighborhoods, on the streets, there is sectarian tensions, but the central political divides, the central divides in the governmental level are not sectarian. They are about the future of Iraq and the degree to which it will be the relationship that it will eventually have with the United States, the relationship that it will eventually have with Iran, and certainly the exploitation of its massive energy wealth.
And Raed Jarrah, do you think that this sort of fictional, we have two fictions here, the government and the army, and as I mentioned, the government wouldn't last 5 minutes outside of the green zone, and the army is apparently riven with fractures and factions. So battle between Iskri and the Sadrists intensifies and continues. I've heard reports that this so-called army is starting to disintegrate along factional lines. Do you have any reports to that effect?
There has been some few army soldiers who surrendered yesterday and the day before and gave away their weapons to Al-Mahdi army. This was political and religious as well. There was one of the four grand Ayatollahs in Iraq who asked the Iraqi armed forces to surrender their weapons and to fight against the central government that he calls a puppet government instead of fighting against their own people. Now, I think it's okay to be simplistic and, when we describe the situation, especially if we just had 5 minutes. But I don't think it's okay to actually speak about the conflict, like the groups in Iraq being the Sunnis or the Shiites. I mean, there is no such a thing as the Sunnis in Iraq or the Kurds. Saying that there is a group called the Sunnis is like saying there is a group in the U.S. called the Whites that mm-hmm. used to fight against the Blacks in a civil war. I mean, it doesn't work that way in Iraq. Which Sunnis are we talking about? Al-Qaeda or the vice president or the armed resistance? Which Shiites are we talking about? Al-Sadr and the nationalists or the Supreme Council and the separatists? So I think the point that Al-Sadr said in Al Jazeera, the one that Joshua just mentioned now, is really important to understand that on an institutional level, there is no such a thing as sectarian conflict or religious conflict. There is a political conflict that is putting some Sunnis and Shiites against other Sunnis and Shiites. Now, what we are witnessing in Basra will continue. It's not a one-week battle. This is an ongoing ideological battle that has been going for the last years and will continue. And what is increasing it is the U.S. Army taking sides between these two fractions, taking the side of a minority of Shiites against the majority of Shiites, a minority of Sunnis against the majority of Sunnis, and etc. So I don't think there is any solution for what's happening on the short run. And I think the best way to try to ease the suffering of Iraqis is to stop propping up a minority of unpopular Iraqis against the majority of the population.
And who specifically are we propping up? Are you talking about Al-Hakim?
Yeah, so the U.S. has been systematically propping up five parties, two Shiites, two Kurds, and one Sunni. From the Shiite side, Al-Hakim and Al-Maliki, Al-Dawah party in the Supreme Council, mm-hmm. have been the U.S. allies systematically during the last 5 years. And that's why they ended up being the only Shiites in the executive branch. The same way that we have Al-Hashimi with his Islamic party, and now some of these awakening groups being the only Sunni allies of the executive of the U.S. government, and therefore they are allowed to stay in the executive branch. The same way with the Kurds and seculars who are allied with the U.S. So, but when you look at the polls in Iraq, these people who are supported by the U.S. and protected and funded and trained, they represent usually less than one-fourth of the population when it comes to their political agenda of partitioning, continuing the occupation, and privatizing Iraq's natural resources. So, I mean, they are for sure a minority. And as Joshua said, the real reason for this conflict now is actually a political reason. After the passage of the provincial law, this minority of U.S.-backed politicians freaked out because they knew that they will lose the elections in the South. And that's why, instead of working harder to win the hearts and minds of Iraqis by making better services or by putting advertisements in TVs, now they sent 50,000 troops to kill their political rivals, of course, with the blessing and backing of the Bush administration. So when you see how dirty this, the politics in Iraq is reaching to, and what type of democracy is this Bush administration backing, you just see why, what's the real reason why 80 or 90% of the Iraqi public wants the U.S. out, because they see the very negative effect of this Bush administration in Iraq, destruction of the Iraqi civil society, governmental institutions, and infrastructure, meddling between Iraqis and supporting some small minorities of unpopular leaders against the majority of the Iraqi people and their leaders. And that's why we always go back to that point of the Iraqi-Iraqi conflict is not happening because Iraqis woke up some morning and decided to attack their neighbors. It's happening because of the U.S. occupation and its agenda there.
Well, just in closing then, Joshua Holland, do you think that given what Raed has told us, it seems to me that in a nutshell, what's going on here is politics by other means, in this case through the barrel of a gun. If you're an American soldier, I can't imagine, the president has never told the soldiers what their mission really is. He's never told the country what the mission is in Iraq. It's changed regularly from various, from securing oil, taking the pressure off Israel, getting rid of a tyrant, bringing democracy to the Middle East. It changes all the time. But now, essentially, what the Petraeus is telling the soldiers in the field is that you're dying for the Iraqis to reconcile. So it seems to me that this is an untenable situation, and that we are largely becoming irrelevant. We're sort of sitting on the sidelines, watching a disaster of our own creation. When Raed says that that everybody hates the Americans and wants them out, is there any way that we'll come to that realization? Because I think this whole thing is essentially comes down to the fact that our president is either delusional or he's a coward. If he either doesn't understand what's really happening there and is delusional, or two, he is a coward who's made a terrible mistake, doesn't know how to fix it, and is going to hand this mess off to the next guy or girl.
Well, I think that that's absolutely right. He clearly wants to hand it off. He has no answer to any of this, and he has a poor understanding of what's going on the ground. I would point out that all of the steps that have been taken to create a new Iraqi state have been done on a timeline and using techniques that were to appeal to a domestic political audience here in the United States. And we, you know, because of that, many of the best practices that we know from various other experiences in post-conflict reconstruction were ignored, were laid by the side, right? We rushed these elections because George Bush needed to have the photo op of the Iraqis waving their purple fingers. But there was not a real effort to create politically neutral democratic institutions. And so we end up with a situation where we have dismantled the Iraqi state, the entirety of the Iraqi state, and replaced it with a shaky coalition of various groups that don't have the confidence of the Iraqi people, that don't have the consent of the governed. And when that's the situation, it will inevitably be, as you describe it, politics by the gun barrel, and that's what we're seeing.
I thank both of you for joining us in Los Angeles. I'm sorry we've run out of time. This obviously we've barely scratched the surface here, but thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Raed Jarrah and Joshua Holland. Their work appears on Alternet. Raed Jarrah is a Iraqi-born architect, political analyst, moved to the United States in 2005. He was the director of the only door-to-door casualty survey in Iraq in 2003. And Joshua Holland is the winner of the 2007 Project Censored Award. I'm now speaking with Dr. Michael Perelman, who's a professor of economics at Cal State University at Chico's, an author of 20 highly regarded books on economics. His latest, The Confiscation of American Prosperity, From Right-Wing Extremism and Economic Ideology to the Next Great Depression. And before we get totally gloomy here, Michael, in terms of a depression, it seems to me, and some have suggested that this subprime meltdown, which of course is yet to bottom out, we don't really know the full extent of it. We've seen companies like the fifth largest investment bank, Bear Stearns, go under. There's obviously other icebergs, financial icebergs, about to hit Wall Street. But it's just based on what we know. Can you make the case that in George Bush's ownership society, where he touted this idea that more and more people own homes under his watch, it turns out that they didn't really own them. They got conned with these so-called ninja loans, no income, job, and assets. The people on Wall Street who packaged these loans and then suddenly through some financial alchemy turned these ninja loans into AAA securities and sold them all around the world. They all made out like bandits, and now the largely poor minority community, new homeowners, upwardly mobile, who got into these bad loans, are now being foreclosed on. And I understand that if you step back and look at this, this may be one of the greatest transfers of wealth in American history.
Well, that was the subject of the first chapter of the book, The Transfer of Wealth. And the transfer of wealth, I think, is both a cause and a result. That is, if you go back and you look at what's happened since around 1970, almost all of the increase in growth and income has gone to the upper 10%. and almost all of that went to the upper 10% of the upper 10%, and so on and so forth. So what you had was lots of people, you used the term upwardly mobile, lots of people have been downwardly mobile or stagnant. So what that meant was that people didn't have much money. And another part of this whole process was that taxes were cut. So the communities didn't have the wherewithal to maintain neighborhoods and to maintain education. So people felt a need to have better homes for other reasons just than to have more square feet of living room. So you have that set up. At the same time, another process going on was that there was no production going on. I mean, there was production, but there was no growth in production to speak of. Investment of the Standard & Poor's non-manufacturing companies was stagnant for years and years and years, decades. And when you look at manufacturing companies, many of those were making their money off finance. Like the automobile companies, their profits were all coming off their financial arms, not producing cars. So you have the situation where the only action is in finance. And then you get the deregulation, of course, and that's not just George Bush. Robert Rubin, who was Secretary of Treasury under Clinton, was overseeing the deregulation of by eliminating the Glass-Steagall Act, which made much of this possible.
In other words, the wall between banks and investment banks.
Exactly. And then he hops over, and he's running Citibank after Citibank starts to implode. And he's interviewed, and they say, well, what about these CDOs? CDOs are collateralized debt obligations. And he said, well, I never heard of them. So here's a guy who's responsible on both sides, the regulatory and the financial side, and he doesn't even know what's happening.
Well, but in terms of the specific meltdown that now that may be dragging the economy into you know some kind of morass we don't even know about, the history of this subprime meltdown is pretty clear that all the state's attorney generals saw this coming, and they tried to get the feds to act, and the Bush administration found some obscure 1843 Bank Act, and they federalized any efforts to look into the subprime market, and therefore protected these predatory lenders. It's the same thing that happened out here in California when the FERC, the Energy Regulatory Committee,
right,
sat on their hands while Bush and Ken Lay and their friends from Texas stole $30 billion from the state of California. And Gray Davis, you know, was hung out to dry, and Schwarzenegger came in as a result, and Davis couldn't get the FERC to move. So this seems to be the MO here with the Bush people, is that they basically enable massive theft by strangling or subduing the regulatory body in the federal government.
I don't want to let Bush off the hook. And you're absolutely correct in everything you said. The only thing I would question would be that it is a longer-term process that's been going on for decades of deregulation and redistribution of income and letting corporations do whatever the hell they want.
Oh, I agree. And I think in many ways we're living in Adam Smith's world, because if you track household income and productivity, they went parallel up until about the year 2000, and productivity has gone steadily up and household income has gone steadily down. So that, I think, at least that chart, if you will, makes it pretty clear that labor is not the beneficiary of productivity, but capital is. And it's enough to make you a Marxist, frankly.
Yeah. 2 points. First of all, the textbooks, you might be interested to know, all still say that labor will get the benefits of productivity. So the textbooks haven't caught up with reality in that respect. Also, you said we're living in Adam Smith's world, and I have to disagree with you there, because Adam Smith said there are three things that the government should take responsibility for. And that was the government, and that was infrastructure, like roads, and that was the military. And we've gone well beyond that. We've privatize those things, or we're in the process of privatizing those things as well.
Well, I think I meant in Adam Smith's world in the sense that capital transcends nationality. I think what is happening here that we are creating a kind of global elite,
yes,
that doesn't have any allegiance to countries. I don't believe that our capitalists are particularly loyal to our country. They park their profits offshore, they'll in the blink of an eye shut down an American town and move the factory to Sri Lanka, still wear flag lapel pins.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
So where are we heading here? Because it seems that this, we're not bothering out. We had this sort of display where Paulson came up on Friday with a new plan that would give the Fed wide new power. They're proposing more oversight, but not a tightening of regulation.
No teeth. You ask where we're going.
Yeah.
You watch a drunk stumbling on the street, and the drunk looks like he's going to fall over, and he sort of rights himself a little bit and continues to stumble a few more feet. And this will go on until the drunk finally falls down. So we might be bottoming out. We have no way of knowing. That is, economists are still debating about whether we're actually in a recession or not. But the problem is that it's going to take a tremendous reorganization of society to get rid of the problems that we have. The way capitalism traditionally gets rid of it is they go through a depression, they wring out the mess, but in the process they bring down millions of families and cause tremendous devastation, and they wreck productivity of new and emergent businesses and ideas for a long period of time. And these depressions can take, well, we had one in the 1870s that lasted about 20 years. We had one that started in 1929, and we didn't get out of that until World War II without the war. No telling how long that would last. But this has been the history of capitalism. So we'll probably have something serious. Whether this is going to be the one, like they talk in San Francisco about the big one, the earthquake that's coming, we don't know if this is going to be the big one or if it's just a tremor, but it's inevitable that we will have something very serious, something traumatic, and that many, many innocent people are going to be hurt in the process.
Well, it seems that if you want to sort of take the analogy of 29, the crash happened, and it took several years before the depression really sunk in. And meanwhile, Herbert Hoover was doing everything or nothing that he should have done. And just recently, a few weeks ago, I spoke with Jamie Galbraith, the economist, son of the famous economist, and he outlined a series of things that the Bush administration could do to turn this situation around. And then he sort of stopped himself and said, but they're not going to do any of it.
Yes. I mean,
so can you make the analogy with 29 and with Hoover? Do we have, is George W. Bush Herbert Hoover?
Oh, no. Herbert Hoover was much better than Bush. Hoover had a much deeper understanding of what was going on. And part of the reason that it took 2 years was that Hoover corralled American business, and he told the corporations, do not cut wages. Do not cut wages. Entirely different rationale than what Bush has. And till about 1931, wages held fairly constant. Now, there were cutbacks in the sense that hours were cut back, and that foremen who were let go would be replacing workmen on the assembly line. But Hoover was actually trying to do something in that sense, but he didn't have the backbone to take really serious action. Whereas Bush, in effect, will do nothing. He doesn't, whether it's lack of understanding or lack of will, or I have no idea. I can't fathom what goes on in the man's mind.
But can you explain why it is that, and maybe it wasn't Bush, maybe it was Cheney, because for all intents and purposes, he apparently runs this government. What happened there when they deliberately stopped the states from intervening with these predatory lenders and federalized it to the point, and then they sat on their hands?
Well, that's the strict ideology that they have. I mean, that's
You don't think it's letting their friends raid the treasury, or you think it's ideology?
I think part of the back scratching is their ideology. It's ideology. It's corruption. The two blend together with this group.
It seems to me that as this thing shakes down, the other shoe to drop. I mean, if you just think of it from the point of view of the household, and I'm not talking about the people who took out these ninja loans and who are being foreclosed on, but a lot. I think I understand that about 2/3 of all mortgages are variables, which means that as interest rates go up, their household payments go up. Remember, we're borrowing from China to pay for the Iraq war. That's $2 trillion down the drain already. We're borrowing essentially to keep this party going. At some point or other, with the dollar falling, we have to make our debt more attractive because other people won't be buying it anymore. Therefore, it seems logical that interest rates will have to go up. And as interest rates go up on people with variable mortgages, that means more blood has to be wrung out of that stone. People are already spending more on gasoline and food, which are going up precipitously. So I just can't see how some of these households operate, particularly those who have maxed out on their credit cards.
Let me expand on that. And that is the average, the total household debt. You were talking about borrowing money for Iraq, $2 trillion. The total household debt equals about the gross domestic product. These are just households, not government. And it's that spending which has been the barrier that's kept the economy from falling into a depression or recession. That is, household spending beyond its means was what was keeping the economy going, because what you learn in elementary economics is every time a household spends a dollar, then the next household earns some of that money, and you create this chain called the multiplier. So what's going to happen then is that if households pull back and start consuming less, and they'll have to as the dollar declines, that's going to rattle world markets, because a country like China is absolutely dependent on the exports that they're sending to the United States. They already have a huge unemployment problem and a lot of unrest. So it's unclear where all this is going to end up. I mean, what you were saying is correct, but it goes much farther than that. If we cut back on our consumer spending, then business is going to fall on its face in this country, and it will have reverberations around the world.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Michael Perlman, let's put this into the political context of this presidential race. We've got John McCain basically saying that that the people who lent the money in this subprime should not be bailed out, and the people who borrowed the money and who got taken to the cleaners and are now being foreclosed on, kicked out in the street, he's essentially saying, blaming the victim, if you will, that they should have known what they were doing. I don't know what the other two Democrats are saying particularly. Nothing has resonated. But the long and the short of it is that it would seem to me, with a war in Iraq that we've already lost and now may blow up in our faces as things appear to be unraveling, and an economy that's tanking, how can the Republicans get reelected?
Well, the Democrats have managed to pull defeat out of the jaws of victory in the last two elections, and I thought it was a remarkable accomplishment on their part. This is going to be more difficult. But
you mean they're going to really have to work hard to blow this one?
They're going to have to work hard, but, you know, they have such a record of showing a determination to do it, it's possible that they could pull it off. It would be unprecedented to have a bad war and a bad economy at the same time and to lose, but don't underestimate the Democrats. They haven't really spoken. Hillary now is coming and speaking a bit about issues that relate to common people. But there are no substantial programs. They're not really willing to take on the challenge.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Michael Perlman. And we will stay in touch here as the fortunes of so many people in this country diminish and the fortunes of such a small minority increase. That, I guess, will be the enduring historical legacy of George W. Bush.
You said it correctly. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Dr. Michael Perlman, Professor of Economics at Cal State University in Chico, the author of 20 highly regarded books on economics, and his latest, The Confiscation of American Prosperity, From Right-Wing Extremism and Economic Ideology to the Next Depression. I'm now speaking with Nicholas March, who is a research fellow at the International Peace Research Institute in Norway. He's an expert in the international arms trade. Nicholas March has followed the story which broke this week in the New York Times about Efrain Tivaroli, who at the age of 21 received a $300 million contract with the Bush administration to supply arms to the Afghan military. And, of course, questions have been raised about Mr. Tivaroli when it was discovered that he was supplying 40-year-old ammunition made in China, which was then purchased through middlemen. And Nicholas March, given that you follow the arms trade in a follow-up to the article that the New York Times broke, you were suggesting that the suspicious nature of this whole thing, apart from the fact that how did this guy with no qualifications, he's apparently his partner, his professional background was that of a masseur, and it's extraordinary that one could get a $300 million contract with the United States government, which is, by definition, taxpayer money. But you say the suspicious middlemen have been a part of the pattern for purchases of these foreign munitions. Is this, give us a sense of this international landscape out there.
Certainly. The arms trade is tends to be a very shadowy business at times. So what you find in many cases is that the companies involved construct extremely complex deals involving numerous companies, numerous middlemen, which makes it sometimes very hard to investigate or research and find out exactly what's going on. So it's not particularly unusual that this sort of thing is going on in this deal. Although what I'd say is more unusual is that the use of middlemen or very complex networks of companies is something you see much more associated with the developing world. And when you're looking at, say, NATO members, they usually have much tighter arms procurement procedures which they follow. So it's usually much more transparent when you're looking at NATO members.
And I understand that the system operates on what's called an end-user certificate. Is that still how it works?
Yes. I mean, that's the standard document. And what that is in order to prevent, say, the U.S. selling arms to one country and then that country then reselling them on to another country, such as, say, China, which the U.S. wouldn't want to export arms to, you're supposed to provide an end-user certificate, and it means just that. It states that this is the end-user of the equipment. The trouble with those is that they have been very easy to forge because there's no set universal template as to what they should look like. So it's very easy to, say, write a letter supposedly from a defense minister of a country and claim it's an end-user certificate. And you also, with them, have another problem, is that the countries very rarely check afterwards to see whether what has been written on the certificate has actually taken place. And in fact, the U.S. is one of the few countries which do sort of make checks after an export has been made.
And that's the State Department, right? They're supposed to check subcontractors, and they check this against a watch list, right?
Yeah, the State Department has been very active in, as you said, having a watch list, which quite a lot of countries don't even do that, and also quite actively following up arms deals and making sure that the assurances that were made when the export was granted have actually been carried out by the importing countries.
Well, there was a case recently that got a lot of publicity, apart from this extraordinary story of this 21-year-old who got a $300 million contract with the U.S. government with no previous expertise in this business. the case of Viktor Bout, the Russian arms dealer. He was eventually arrested in Thailand, I believe, by the Drug Enforcement Administration,
yeah.
Which is pretty odd, isn't it? What's the DEA doing arresting an arms dealer?
Well, I mean, Viktor Bout had become absolutely notorious for his involvement in illicit arms deals. So he's one of the parties who are supplying the Taliban in the 1990s. He was involved in pretty much every civil war on the African continent, very often supplying both sides. So there was, in the late 1990s, an attempt by the U.S. and especially people within the State Department to try to bring him to justice. And you had the Treasury, Department of the Treasury, introduce various sanctions against him. You also had Interpol issued an international arrest warrant against him. So there was a concerted effort to try to prevent him supplying arms to all of these very dubious parties.
So I can understand on the Russian or former Soviet side that you probably have system disintegrates. There were tons and tons of arms in the satellites, like the Ukraine and other places, and these have all been flooding the markets. And somehow, Bout and others were able to get in on that stuff. But what is the relationship with people like Viktor Bout and the Kremlin, or what's the relationship on our side, which raises questions as a result of this 21-year-old? I mean, how do you get to these big arms caches?
Well, it's like any other business, really. You have to develop contacts. You have to know the right people. Viktor Bout, it's alleged. We don't have much hard information about him, but certainly alleged that he had lots of good contacts within the former Soviet Union intelligence services. And you know, these characters stayed around after the fall of the Soviet Union.
I think the President Putin is one of them, isn't he?
possibly. But again, we're looking at rumors rather
okay.
Facts, so it's difficult to say definitively. With this company, AEY, obviously they didn't have much experience, but it seems that they were working with other people, other middlemen who did have those contacts. So what you can do if you can get in touch with them, you can buy into their networks. And obviously, you know, the brokers who are acting as middlemen will need some kind of compensation for doing that.
So I guess the way that this guy must have made a fortune, this 21-year-old down in Miami. He got a $300 million contract with the Pentagon to supply small arms ammunition to the Afghan military that we're training and trying to stand up. And apparently he went around the world and found these old stocks in places like Albania that were, you know, 30, 40-year-old Chinese AK-47 ammunition, and he repackaged it and sold it for considerable profit. And I take it that he also paid off a lot of people in Albania, and they only got busted, I think it was the defense minister, because a warehouse of this old defective ammunition blew up.
Mr. Divarolia, I assume he's managed to find the cheapest source of ammunition probably in the entire world. I mean, it's difficult to imagine any other ammunition which would be cheaper than sort of 40-year-old Chinese stocks in Albania. So again, this is just like any other business in that you're sourcing something as cheap as possible, and then you're trying to sell it for as high a price as you can. What's amazing to me is he actually managed to get this, enormous contract from the Department of Defense.
It is amazing, and it was never clear in the New York Times article. I mean, they gave this front page coverage, but they didn't really get down to the nub of it. Is it who on the Department of Defense issued this contract? It's, I mean, we know that this kid was the lowest bidder, but he had no background. And as I say, his partner was a masseur, and they ran it all out of a condominium in Florida. It's kind of surreal, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you read that in a book or saw it in a film, you just wouldn't believe it, would you? As you said, if they're putting in the lowest price, then I presume that that's the criteria that was used. But, you know, obviously any sensible administration issuing these sort of contracts worth hundreds of millions of dollars should also look at whether the person who offers the lowest price actually has the capacity to deliver. And, you know, it seems with these people, they clearly didn't.
Well, that's one of the amazing things about the current Bush administration, is that apparently you're not required to be competent. I mean, we recall with Katrina down in Florida, the head of FEMA, a heck of a job, Brownie. It's sort of smacks of this, you know. You can get 21-year-old can get a $300 million contract, and they don't really have to perform. So, what is this? Does this indicate that in general there's no oversight in this shadowy world? Because the bad guys, I guess, are always one step ahead of everybody else, right?
I mean, I'd say there is oversight in places, and what's very interesting from the U.S. perspective is that, as I said, you have within the State Department and other parts of the U.S. government, very good systems, which, you know, people like me go around trying to tell other countries that you really should, copy the model of regulation. But then you have a great big blind spot concerning the Pentagon, and particularly the purchases that have been made under the context of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We mentioned Victor Boot earlier on. He was actually employed to supply logistics services to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. So he was getting paid from there at the same time as other parts of the U.S. government were trying to arrest him. And you have other examples of, again, weapons being purchased in Eastern Europe, particularly in Bosnia, where, again, the deals were extremely complex. They used all sorts of middlemen. And, again, you have, in the case of the Bosnian assault rifles, it's very difficult to see that they all actually arrived in Iraq. There's a possibility and a certainly great concern that they could have ended up somewhere else in the world.
Well, you know, Nicholas Marshall, and just in closing then, what about the I mean, it's ridiculous to bring up the notion of morality, but you're saying that there are some arms traders that are less disgraceful than others, right? And the work that you do in Sweden, I mean, in Norway with the International Peace Research Institute is an attempt to bring about some transparency and some kind of regime. So, what give us a sense of the moral landscape here?
I mean, as you're saying, it's very varied. I mean, you know, certainly if there are many activities which are perfectly legitimate for which you require arms. I mean, policing, peacekeeping, or even self-defense of a state. So, I mean, parts of the arms trade, I'd say, are legitimate and are necessary. The trouble is that the very large parts of the arms trade are completely unregulated, out of control, and because of the secrecy which surrounds the trade, it's very, very easy for people to be involved in corruption, to be involved in fraud, which they couldn't get away with in other industries because they're more transparent. So, part of what we're trying to do is to gather all the data we can find and publish it to increase the levels of transparency.
That's what they call name and shame.
Well, part of that, yeah.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Nicholas Marsh.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Nicholas Marsh, who's a research fellow at the International Peace Research Institute in Norway. He's an expert on the international arms trade. And, of course, this week the New York Times broke a story where a 21-year-old with no previous experience in the arms business was able to get a $300 million contract with the Pentagon, your money, again, taxpayer money, and he was supplying 40-year-old ammunition to the Afghan army that we are trying to build to fight the resurgent Taliban. Go figure. Let me thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong and Lichter One, the assistant producers, and G, the engineers.